This is the second half of an interview between one of the founders of WRIRLP, Liz Skrabashevsky, and playwright Clay McLeod Chapman. Production and editing were by Jared Russell and Harvey Hall of WRIRLP in Richmond, Virginia. This interview was recorded January 24, 2005 in Richmond, Virginia, just previous to his performance at Richmond's Firehouse Theater.
If you read Richmond newspapers, Clay McLeod Chapman's name is everywhere. Carrie Neiman of Style Weekly wrote a beautiful feature on his creative genius this week. C3 hired him to speak there last week. The Firehouse Theater commissioned him to write the play that he's performing there over the next 2 weeks. All of these people, the people who love his work, are writers. Why do writers love him? In my opinion, it's because he's fearless. Imagine yourself in bed at night and lingering in the crevices of your mind, looking for that last thought, waiting to fall asleep. The thoughts that seep in are dark, humorously dark. They are also the words most of us would never dare speak aloud. Those thoughts, Republican Congress spends billions to keep silently put to bed. Clay's writing is a celebration of the dark, perverted hilarity that comes only when a mind is completely at rest. He's like finding a Toblerone or Godiva chocolate bar in an alley, dropped next to a puddle, and picking it up and eating it. Richly sweet, dark, and perverted. Writers love him because he's not afraid to explore places where we would never go. His mind hand sews cocktail dresses on cockroaches and lingers in dumpsters to see what the view becomes. His subjects include rodeo clowns, hermaphrodites, and sexually frustrated ventriloquist dummies. You, me, a lot of us don't go there. The forbidden places of oddity and exploitation. He puts his out in public, like Grimm's fairy tales for adults. The writers who love him, the Firehouse Theater, for example, are not wrong in their passion of Clay. He's won the MacArthur Genius Award for $100,000. MacArthur, as in this program brought to you by the MacArthur Foundation, heard daily on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Car Talk. Clay's also written 2 books, Rest Area and Miss Corpus, and recently had one of his short stories converted into a film that was aired at the Sundance Film Festival. And his off-Broadway theater production of The Pumpkin Pie Show has played in Brooklyn for 8 years. Clay McLeod Chapman is only 27. The best way to describe Clay's work is to let Clay read it.
I did that piece for a group of like 9th to 10th to 12th graders, assuming, and this was the first time that I had read it, and I was under the assumption that who better to read this piece for, like who would understand this piece more than anyone else? Of course the people who are going through it themselves, of course, like, you know, there would be this sense of, well, here we are, we're all in this together, I've been there, you're there right now. Like, this is as close to a literary sex ed movie film strip that you're going to have. And I thought they would enjoy it. I thought it would be fun. Did it. Pretty quiet. You know, could hear the crickets chirping. And I left that school thinking that, you know, that didn't go great. But wasn't until probably like an hour or so later that I got a phone call from the principal, saying that we had to have a talk, and two of these English teachers had come in, the principal was there, the art teacher. You know, it took that one kid to go home, tell their mom, you know, this crazy guy came into class today, started ranting and raving about pirates and sex and water slides, and all of a sudden, like, I found myself in the position of needing to apologize to these students. And the only reason why I bring it up is because...
No! Don't you dare interrupt your stories.
No! I mean, like, to me, like, this happened 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and this was.
And Clay is 27, so you were 21 at the time.
Yeah.
Oh my God, just a kid.
Yeah, just a kid going into this group of kids, and you know, not. I totally thought it was going to be. I thought they would love it. I thought they would eat it up, and a few of them did, and I mean, a lot of them did. But it just took that one to not enjoy it so much and have the parent who kind of got nervous about it. And to me, the whole point to the story is to say that, I mean, I think this is the common...
I have to hear about this apology. Did they bring you back into the auditorium?
No. It wasn't that I had to apologize to the students as much as I had to write an apology and say, like, you know, I this was not my intention. I mean, being 21, like, I was definitely, you know, to me, the depth charge, like, I wasn't planning on going in there to drop an A-bomb. I didn't want to, like, destroy the sensibilities of our fragile youth. I wanted to tell a story that I thought that they would appreciate on a level that wasn't, you know, that they could at least identify with on the level of this isn't someone much older than us.
Right.
I mean, frankly, I felt closer to them. I still feel closer to that age range than I do with the teachers. And it's just because, you know, through the public school system, the private school system, and just through the, you know, schools in general, there's this fear of talking about sex and this fear about talking about these things. And that's where stories like Johnny Pumpkinseed and the Pool Witch come from. It's because there isn't that conversation that we have. We relegate it to, you know, the sit down with your parents and here's the birds and bees, or here's this video where we're going to pop in and this is going to explain everything to you that's happening to you right now.
Right.
And I remember watching a sex ed class, a sex ed video in my gym class, and being more confused than I was before.
Right.
And it's because it's so, you see these teachers being so trepidatious around it because we have to skirt around the topic as opposed to actually talking about it. We relegate it to a video. We relegate it to these other things beyond ourselves. It's almost like adults, like, hold their hands up and say, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to let this do it, because it takes that one off-color comment or that one thing that goes outside.
You know, but it is the subject that nobody talks about, you know, sexy. And sexy, I was reading in Interpreter of Melody, she said, sexy is loving something that you don't know, you know, or somebody that you don't know. And nobody does talk about it. And yet, with the children, we have to talk about it, although it's something that we're not comfortable with ourselves, you know, and it is completely taboo. And so to handle it face on or head on is completely contrary to, you know, 35 years of previous learning, you know, and I have to argue with you. I mean, there is no other way to handle it with children. You know, you can put it out there, but, you know, but it's difficult. And to put it out there, it's almost like you're making fun of the subject.
Making fun of the subject being sex?
The subject being sex, or be, you know, or the boys, you know, who are completely frustrated. And that was another question that I had to ask. You know, do you make fun of your subject or make fun of your subject matter?
I think it would depend on the story.
Okay.
I think
these boys, for example, were you making fun of them?
No, I wasn't. I think if anything, it was, to me, I mean, that I have a soft spot for that story because I feel like it embraces the clumsiness of adolescence. I wasn't making fun of them at all. I think if anything, it was, I mean,
it does, you know, and I want to back up, and it does embrace the clumsiness of adolescence, and it's hilarious and wonderful, but finish your point.
Well, I mean, there is that awkwardness that has to be acknowledged, like, and I think, you know, if it's the first date syndrome, you know, you're going to be tongue-tied, you're going to have the sweaty palms, you're going to just be nervous, and I think that that's something to, if it's not something to be discussed, if it's not something that we want our gym teachers to kind of come out and talk one-on-one with us with, and I agree with that. I think I would freak out if Mr. Morgan, my ninth grade gym teacher, you know, sat me down and was like, this is what it is, this is how it's going to be, this is what you're in for, here it comes. But I do think it's a gray area. There's an immense sense of ambiguity that begins with the first hair that sprouts under your armpit, and, you know, goes all the way through. And
yeah, you know, until you die, to be honest with
you.
Yeah,
well,
you know?
Yeah, it hasn't gotten any easier, that's for sure. Yeah. But I think that because of that, because the enormity of the gray area of that sex is, and then this taboo, it's an immense resource. It's something to explore. And, I mean, I have to call a spade and say, Pool Witch? I was 18 when I wrote that.
Right.
I mean, that was like, I mean, I look back at that now, and I say to myself, well, I was just I was coming off the other end of this whole hormonal overdrive. So, I mean, to a certain degree, like I have to acknowledge that in writing these pieces, and a lot of the more taboo, sex-oriented pieces that I've written, they were written at a point when I was in the trenches, or at least kind of coming off of the battlefield. And now with things like party favors, I don't know if it's a certain sense of maturation. I don't know if I'm growing up. I don't know if I'm getting tired of writing about sex.
I think you just said it extremely well. You know, at 18, 19, 20, 21, I mean, everybody's still fascinated with it, you know? Yeah. And, you know, the illusion kind of wears off after, you know, 10 years of bumping and grinding.
Well, I totally have to admit, the only things, if I want to write something funny, it's usually about sex. Like, I only think sex is funny, and that's the only thing that I've ever had the ability to write comedically about. For some reason, I think I'm stuck in this kind of static duality of comedy pieces revolve around sex, and the more dramatic, serious pieces deal with death, and that's kind of the pop psychology of it at this point. And there's an immense variations within, but when you get down to it, that's usually the paradigm.
Does it ever exhaust you, or do you get sick of being, you know, sick?
I think I'm okay.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't feel. I mean, I'm. Well, here's what I'll say. When I was in high school and I was going through the beginnings of this hormonal overdrive, and having, you know, trying to figure out how to channel that this new energy resource that my body was like pumping, like, you know, every day, I was lucky enough to find the Metro, you know, and like have this I was lucky enough to find Hose Got Cable or a Veil, and like suddenly there was this new outlet for it. Like I had punk rock,
right?
You know, like being this little kid going to these you know, all ages, you know, shows, and jumping in the pit and having some like VCU student punch my lights out or something. Like all of a sudden there was that like, here was a group of people who, with this unchecked aggression, this thing that I kind of quantified as testosterone release. You know, punk was that the initial kind of outlet for it, or this was the safe haven in which to express that
right,
pent up, and having the subsequent release. If it wasn't going to be actual sexual intercourse, it was going to be something else.
Physical expression of another form.
Someone picks up a football, starts, you know, pounding quarterbacks into the ground. You know, I found a mosh pit. Nice. I found Action Patrol. You know, these are the things that I, you know, it was just the avenue that I went down. And with the writing, you know, something that kind of developed from that point on, you know, taking the kind of theatrical elements to it or the literary elements to it, and finding a way in which to channel that same hormonal drive and put it into something more focused, more streamlined, and instead of just expressing it by way of the physical interaction in a mosh pit, how could you intellectualize it? How could you dramatize it? And that's how pieces like The Pool Witch or Johnny Pumpkinseed came about. It was taking that same resource, that same energy supply, and somehow just channeling it, pushing it into a different direction. So that's why there is a kind of sexual undertone to it. That's why whatever level of perversion there is, I think it's because, I mean, I think punk rock is pretty perverted. I think it's one of those things where you see this emotional, this anger, this sense that comes out. And how does it come out? It comes out in the music. It comes out in this ability to like draw people in. And I wanted to take that same sensibility that I thought, at least a foundation or just a root of it, was hormones, or this kind of like this physical source that didn't have the immediate outlet, taking that and literalizing it or dramatizing it, and that's how a lot of the writing started. I wanted it to be at that point punk rock writing. I wanted it to be like punk rock theater. Whether it is or isn't, I mean, that's to me kind of the the dramaturgy behind it. That's where it started.
Wow.
So to me, it's not sick. It's not crazy. It's not these things that I think people...
It's fringe.
Yeah. Well, it's only fringe because it's the stuff that we don't want to look at. And I think that, you can turn over a rock and you're going to find a lot of stuff there. It's your choice to do it. I choose to. It's not a judgment call on my part. It's not something that I personally feel like makes me a better or worse person. It's just that that's where my attention goes. I go to home. I'm going to sleep a sound, happy sleep. I'm going to have dreams of bunnies and, nice things. I'm going to play lottery tomorrow. I'm going to watch the 6 o'clock news. I'm going to, my lifestyle is what it is, and the writing is something independent of that. So I think...
Nothing. That's what I like about you, mm-hmm. is that you're not... a lot of writers write themselves into their work, and you're very aware of the writer. And although when we read your stuff, we go, oh, my God, this guy's a little twisted. it's not... Your writing is its own person, and you're very generous with it and not self... I don't know. You're separate from it. And this is one of those things that I'm going to cut out. No, but it's different. It's separate from yourself. And you're not self-centered in it or self-seeking in it. It's not a big glorification of you. It's a glorification of your subject.
Yeah. Well, it was odd. There was, in high school, one of the other things that I found was that there was, the Beat movement. One of the first kind of I think the Beats were kind of the punk rocks of their time. It was taking the form and turning it on a dime, changing it just enough that there was a certain self-awareness to it. I loved William S. Burroughs in high school. I thought he was amazing. He totally influenced me in the beginning. There's Kerouac and there's Ginsberg. And there was a exhibit in New York at I think MoMA, where they had the Beats. They had all of their writing, they had photographs that Ginsberg had taken. It was just a huge exhibit on the Beat poets and the Beat writers. And I went really excited about it, thinking that this would be fun. And I looked at all the people who were there. This was when I was in college. I was like freshman in college. And I noticed a lot of the other people who were there were my age. They were young, but they dressed just like Jack Kerouac. And they had, they looked like William S. Burroughs. And it really kind of, I got angry because I recognized that there was this ability to, the cult of personality had taken over. That there was this sense of, it's difficult to disconnect or disassociate these particular authors from their material. They, as the writer, are equally as important as the material is. Uh-huh. I'm not a big fan of reading Allen Ginsberg's work. I'm a big fan of hearing him read it himself.
Sure.
There's something amazing about seeing William S. Burroughs or hearing William S. Burroughs give a recording of his material where you hear that long draw and it sounds like a gravelly, asphalt voice.
Right.
And there's something so integral to them as the impetus and as the source behind it.
Exactly.
But it just got me so scared because I realized that, I couldn't take the work away. I couldn't read Naked Lunch without Burroughs kind of overshadowing
sure,
it.
Sure, being completely aware.
Yeah, and that made me nervous. It made me aware of how much Hunter S. Thompson, he has to be the foundation of his work, as any writer is. But what amazes me is that someone like Faulkner or someone like, I want to say Fitzgerald, but you have these writers who they instill themselves and their sensibilities into their work.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of the day, they're completely independent of it.
Exactly.
Ginsberg, Kerouac, their lifestyle seemed to be what pushed the work more than anything. And I just got nervous about that. And I think that there has been this kind of author disassociation from the material. I'm going to die. I'm going to die one day. And what freaks me out more than anything is that you know, instead of trying to kind of put an autobiographical discourse of my existence into print form.
I don't ever see you doing that. I don't see you as the kind of person to write a memoir. You know?
No, I don't need to.
I don't see you need. Sorry, I'm finished.
No, I mean, I think the author just needs to be a non-entity. I think that, yeah. I mean, there's something great about embracing the work and catapulting the work to a higher arena. That's why I love doing readings. That's why I love doing performances. That is a portion of it.
Right.
But the foundation of the work always has to be the material itself. Right. Like, I have to let go. It has to have an existence independent of myself.
Right.
And if it doesn't, it's a faulty foundation, and it's not going to go anywhere. And it'll dissipate as soon as I step away from it. And that's the challenge at this point for me.
You are not a rock star writer. You know, rock star has to perform his song for the most part to be heard the way it's supposed to be heard.
Yeah.
You know, Ginsberg has to perform it, but you, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there are a lot of stumbles and trips along the way. Like, I think at this point, the only way people are going to know about my work is if I let them know about it. I am dead set on doing readings and performances and getting the material out there as much as possible. But it's kind of conversion theory. You know, if I can go into a school and go to a group of 20 to 30 students and they have no idea who I am, and then all of a sudden I read a story. If I can convince one or two of them, five of them, that I'm worth taking home with them, there's the book. So, and it just takes that one performance, that one reading, to then say, hey, this is pretty cool. I'd like to read the other 19 stories in this book, so I'm going to pick it up and take it home with me. And it's just the fact that I have to meet them halfway. And that's what the readings and performances are for me. Letting people know about it and like exposing them to this resource, this literary entity that is out there.
So what about film? I mean, was it a short? Tell me about this movie that was at Sundance that you did.
It's pretty loopy. I have this story called Late Bloomer yet again. So it's one of the funny stories, so it's about sex. It's a seventh grade sex ed class that just goes from really bad to really worse. It's because, again, they don't have the vocabulary to understand what's happening to their bodies. But the whole joke behind it is that it's from the perspective of one of the students, but told by way of these H.P. Lovecraft stories. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft was this creepy, funky, horror writer. Like, you go Poe, you go Lovecraft, you go King. And Lovecraft always had this, like, the Cthulhu mythos. And to me, it was because I was teaching a playwriting workshop to a group of high school students, and the first day before I even get into the class, like the person in charge said, these are the things you can't talk about. These are the rules that you have to follow. You can't talk about sex. The conversations can never go to sex. You can't, like, if you touch anything above or below the shoulder, that's grounds for getting kicked out of here. And it wasn't as if I was going to talk about sex with them.
Right.
It wasn't like it was on the forefront of my mind. But the second they told me I couldn't,
that was
all I wanted to chat on about. So I got so frustrated that the way it kind of like materialized was, yeah, exactly. Late Bloomer. It was just this short story about this sex ed class that turns into, it's because they couldn't talk about it. In a sex ed class, that suddenly it becomes this monster mash, and like, you know, the chalk renditions on the blackboard at the front of the class turn into octopus monsters, and like all of a sudden it becomes, you know, just a comedy of misunderstanding, essentially.
So maybe that's it.
What's that?
Our obsession with sex, this national obsession, and the fact that we can't talk about it, you know, so everybody, it's leaching out everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, in sideways directions, because we're just so pent up and frustrated.
Yeah, well,
it should just be open. Go ahead.
Well, it's welling up inside us all, for sure. And then it's the only reason why it becomes perversion, the only reason why it becomes something that isn't culturally accepted or mainstreamly accepted as kind of our understanding of sex is because it does well up to us, well up in us to the point where it finds its release in our armpit, or it goes out. It goes out in a different direction, and that's it's that sideways release that becomes subversive or taboo, because it isn't through the front door; it's through the back window, or you know. And that's the. I mean, I think that's the difference. But I wrote this piece in response to not being able to talk about it with this group of high school students. And the piece, it was a funny piece. It was a goofy piece. And I wrote it 2000 and had been reading it in different places, performing it. And this one guy had been in the audience. He was a filmmaker. And he approached me afterwards, said, "I really love the piece. I want to talk about the possibility of turning it into a short film." And I'd had people approach me about short films before. I've had short films done on with particular pieces. And they've just never been good enough to really embrace. So I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, sure, go for it. Wasn't going to affect me in any indirect or direct way that it would be my fault if it wasn't good.
Right.
But this guy turned out to be this agent working at a commercial film and photography agency. And he was essentially representing, you know, the directors who shot all these Nike ads and Nissan ads and, I mean, you name it. And he had never done a film before. This was his first step into it. But he had all of these favor cards that he could just pull. So all of a sudden, this short film, this 12-minute film, has the director of photography who shoots these national commercial ads. And he sinks $20,000 into 12 minutes of celluloid. And I'm thinking, I could have lived off of that for a year. Right, and you go, you know, like 2 years, and you've crammed it into 12 minutes of film. And I thought it was crazy. I more power to him for doing it. And thank God he was doing it for a peace of mind. And it really worked. It turned out to be amazing. And, you know, as embarrassing as it is to admit, I had no aspirations of it going beyond my VCR, but it ends up like hitting the festival circuit, and all of a sudden, you know, it won a couple of awards, and it, you know, the culminating effort was that it went to Sundance. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm bumping into Benjamin Bratt or seeing Paris Hilton flash skiers down the slopes in Utah, and like, I mean, it was totally goofy. It was like a weird experience, and I loved it, and it was fun to think I was more important than, because Hollywood just like transports itself from California to Park City for 10 days. And you would think that the world centered around these movie people. And it was intimidating and just utterly goofy at the same time. But it was fun. I mean, snow bunnies and, movie stars.
Well, I want to thank you very much. And the play that you have at the Firehouse Theater, how long is that running?
It's running for 4 weeks. Opened up last night. We go till March 19th.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Take care.
Yes.
This is the second half of an interview between one of the founders of WRIRLP, Liz Skrabashevsky, and playwright Clay McLeod Chapman. Production and editing were by Jared Russell and Harvey Hall of WRIRLP in Richmond, Virginia. This interview was recorded January 24, 2005 in Richmond, Virginia, just previous to his performance at Richmond's Firehouse Theater.